Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, January 23rd, 2020. A lot to talk about tonight. SpaceX, very interesting this past week, progressing towards their ability to do manned space flights in the United States. And this would be the first one literally since, using an actual rocket, not the space shuttle thing, but using a rocket going back to literally the Apollo program. And it's an Apollo-like setup. But remember, the Apollo program had an escape rocket, basically, on the front of the capsule that during liftoff, and for actually a very short time thereafter, they had the capability of pulling that capsule off and sending it away so that it could then drop the crew safely into the ocean, a crew of three in the Apollo, but in the SpaceX, they have their space capsule, crew capsule, that would then be on its way to the International Space Station. They're thinking that they might have a manned flight carrying living passengers to the space station this coming spring, which would be a great advantage for the United States since they have depended literally on Russia for launches to the space station for a very, very long time. And even though the shuttle was active during, you know, what, a 10-year period, I don't even know how many years that thing was active, but most of the flights of the United States, including military flights, military hardware, was launched out of Russia. I don't think that SpaceX is going to be able to pick up the entire slack of American launches for some time. Now, I don't know the actual data on that, but just given the number of launches required, I don't think SpaceX is going to start doing 100%, but they, I think, could very quickly get up to about 100% of the U.S. human launches. But understand that that is one aspect of the U.S. space program. And that on a very frequent basis, the United States needs launches of military equipment and other types of equipment. So they're going to still depend on the Russians, which is very interesting because supposedly the Russians are our arch enemies. And, of course, dealing with space, one would think that that would be extremely private. But for decades, we've been shipping our most sensitive military hardware to Russia to launch. It doesn't get any nuttier than that. If this is one thing that's bizarre, is that, you know, the Democrats are so worried about Russia being our arch enemy, and they, you know, nobody ever mentions this. It never comes up on the news. The amount of hypocrisy and contradictions just is beyond astounding, and especially when you get to the science world, politicians really are, you know, baby ignorant, worse than baby ignorant when it comes to science. All they do is they know that they have to send money, and by sending money, they support science, they think. Anyway, but kudos to Elon Musk and SpaceX. They're actually getting stuff done. And, you know, the crew of engineers, I've always said, I'm sure that there was a giant sucking noise when he opened up SpaceX doors. There must have been a giant sucking noise coming from the other aerospace companies as they went flying out the door to actually get something done. And now Boeing has to keep up with this, and they're not doing it. They're not keeping up with SpaceX. The government is guaranteeing Boeing contracts, even though Boeing has not performed. Anyway, that's a story all to itself. I want to give an honorable mention tonight to a guy named Tony Phillips. Dr. Tony Phillips is the human filter for all kinds of government programs. Now, if you look on, just a plethora of websites and news releases, everything from NASA to JPL, Goddard, American Geophysical Union meetings, he is there. I had the misfortune of running into Tony Phillips, and I'll tell you how I met him in a minute. Also, he's the webmaster for spaceweather.com, which is a Rothschild-owned entity along with weather.com and all of the other. Remember that there were many weather pages on the Internet some time ago. Now they're all gone. And the only one that really is left is the weather.com, which is completely owned and controlled. And you cannot, you cannot get good weather information any place anymore. I mean, there's, you have your satellite imagery and stuff like that. But I mean, as far as the good satellite data from outer space, things like that, it's all totally gone. But Tony has been around for decades. And I'm going to try and put my finger on the year when I ran into him. It was during the, it must be about 1995, 96. I was at an American Geophysical Union meeting, and it was dealing with the comet Hale-Bopp. Now, I was there, and I had my poster session. I typically gave a, what is known as a poster session. You have basically a booth, and there are hundreds of booths in a big auditorium. But it's the best way to get traffic to cover your topic. Other people give a talk. It's a, called a session talk. And it's in a, like a, around the auditorium, there are rooms set up with audiovisual materials and equipment, et cetera. And some of the higher level presenters, typically higher level in NASA, JPL, Goddard, et cetera, would give a talk on their specific information. It might be results from Mars, geological survey of Mars, or it might be the solar wind, or it might be other, whatever. Just there's 20,000 scientists at thing in all different fields. And so the, along with all of this, there's a news media room, where the people like myself, presenters, could go and put their information. And you had an actual little spot where you would have your information. And I had many copies printed up, hundreds of them, to hand out to the constituents of the American Geophysical Union meeting. They were printed up, beautiful color prints, and they were, I think they were 8.5 by 11 or something, just regular size sheets, but you could see all the detail. My poster was 60 inches by 40 inches. So this is a big poster, 5 feet by about 3.5 feet tall, and a lot of detail, very dense material. So anyway, I would go into the newsroom, and all of my stack of copies of my poster were gone. I thought, whoa, somebody's taken these. And so then I set a trap. I put a generous pile of my posters, the copies, these smaller ones for people to take, on the table in the news media room, and stood back and watched. And none other than good old Tony Phillips would go in there, look around, and when nobody was looking, snatch my pile of posters and walk off with them, stuff them in his briefcase and leave. So he was the guy taking my posters out of the news media room so nobody would get a hold of them. So, you know, this is pretty amazing, but, you know, clearly did not want people to see my work. And just another little incident happened at, now this was going back to probably earlier than that, possibly back into the 1980s. That I was at an American Geophysical Union meeting. I used to go to these all the time, and then I realized it was a waste of time because none of these people had their head together. None of these people that came from all these, you know, 20,000 scientists, I realized this is tier two. These people are lost in ivory tower never, never land, basically. But Tony Phillips was always there. He was on top of it. If there was a big session dealing with a certain topic, Tony was there. He was the point man to make sure that information flowed out. And he's, like I say, he's the final filter. He's the webmaster for spaceweather.com. He's the final filter for anything NASA, for the American Geophysical Union meetings. This guy gets around. Okay, so anyway, just thought I'd give a little honorable mention there about Tony. And another little story, anecdote, regarding the American Geophysical Union meeting. I was there and had my booth, and I had my poster up. In fact, if you buy my three posters set, the very earliest poster is the one I'm talking about here. It was up on a board, and I had it very nice. It was full size. Once again, it's 40 inches high by 60 inches wide, big colorful photo. And you can go and actually see it on my webpage. Even if you don't buy it, you can go there and see it. Go to my sales page, scroll down to the where the books, the covers of the books are, etc. Go to jmccsci.com, click on the link to the sales page, the secure web ordering sales page, and then scroll down to where the books and the DVDs, etc. are defined. And then the very last thing is the poster set, three poster set. And the very earliest poster is the poster I am talking about at this particular meeting. And I was standing there, and there was a group that formed, and I could tell they were students. You can tell students, graduate students, they're all kind of sloppily dressed, kind of hippie-ish almost. You know, clearly not people that have enough money to buy good shoes or good clothes. They're struggling graduate students. And so anyway, in front was a guy with a suit on, and that was Michael Muma. And I don't know if Michael's still around, but him and I had some, let's say we did not agree on many things. And so anyway, Michael was standing there with all these graduate students, probably I'd say about 15, maybe 10, maybe time is exaggerating, but at least 10 graduate students standing behind him, and they're all standing there looking at me with my table, and I have a computer there with slides flashing up on it, and basically in big letters it says comets are not dirty snowballs. And you can see this poster. It's like I say, go down there on my webpage, you can see it. So anyway, Michael comes over. It's about a 20-foot walk from the group of grad students where he's standing there looking at me, comes over to me, and he confronts me. And he says, see, you got some posters and a computer here, yeah? And he goes, you know, kind of, what's all this all about? And I'm like, well, you know, this is comets are not dirty snowballs. And, you know, I talked to him for a while. And, of course, he knew who I was. He knew, Michael Muman knew who I was. And he tells you, well, we got a problem here. I go, oh, yeah, what's the problem? And he says, well, you know, and he starts to hem and haw. And I said, oh, you mean that published papers, published new materials should only advance science a little bit by a wiggle worm inch, and be published in a peer-reviewed journal, and that should be what I'm doing here. I shouldn't be challenging the basic construct of science. And he goes, yeah, that's right. And so anyway, I had a few choice words for him, and he walked away, and then all the graduate students turned around and marched along with him. I could go on and on about the incidents I had at American Geophysical Union meetings, but the one guy that was always front and present was Tony Phillips. And so, and he's in the news. You'll see his name if you go to any news release. Typically, Tony's name will be on it. And he's the guy that has guided basically the output of NASA, the public view of NASA, for decades. Okay, well, anyway, enough honorable mention there. Just a quick comment here, and of course people are sending this in all over the place. I've been talking about chemicals in the water for you know what, 2 decades I've been selling my water filters. But now there's more and more evidence. They're called PFAs, Paul Frank Alpha, and PFAs. And they're now being called forever chemicals. And they're forever for a reason. One is they stay forever in the water table. And number two, they stay forever in your body. And so there are efforts now to try and get these out of your body if you have them. But they're severe carcinogens. They cause cancer, liver damage, low birth weight. In other words, pregnant mothers and prenatal mothers, if they're getting these chemicals, can cause their babies to have low weight. So anyway, there are things like Teflon, Scotchgard, some of the chemicals that you find in firefighting foam that have been used, and the military uses a lot of this stuff in practice, etc. And it kind of goes away, you know, you spray it, and it's like foam. It's like a kind of soap suds, and it smothers the fire. That's the whole idea. It robs the fire of oxygen and puts it out. But that's one of the PFAs, one of the chemicals, and the list goes on and on. But people are just starting to wake up to this. And, of course, I've been warning people about this for a very long time. I'm very careful myself to drink filtered water. And so the other issue here is that the EPA, the Environmental Pollution Agency, I call it, has allowed this pollution to go on for decades. What the EPA does, it's not the Environmental Protection Agency. It's the agency that allows companies to pollute up to a certain limit. But the issue is that if you're polluting that limit every year, then, of course, you can cheat a little bit or a lot. And there were companies like 3M in Minnesota, Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, had a truck where all of the chemists would dump their material. It was a big, basically, tanker truck. And that truck would drive out into the country over by the Mississippi River, in the countryside, and they had a barn. It was just a barn there, nothing else. And the truck would drive in and dump this chemical load down a hole in the ground. Wow. I mean, it just doesn't get any worse. And they finally caught them at it. They actually caught them. And of course, then the EPA comes along, gives them a fine. Well, you know, what they found out also is that the EPA would bargain with these companies when the companies would come in and they would, you know, get their EPA certification for dumping a certain quantity of chemicals into the water table. The EPA would tell them what their fine would be if they got caught breaking the rules. So the companies like 3M or other companies would put that cost in their products, in their end product. They would actually add it into the end product cost. So if they ever got caught, the money that they would pay in the fine was already there, and it was in a slush fund paid by you, the customer, already up front. So when they got the slap on the hand and the fine, hey, it was no big deal. It was just like, okay, here's the money. And then you'd look in the paper, and, you know, a $3 million fine. Well, for a company like 3M, that's like a penny to you, less than a penny to you. You know, it's nothing. And you know, they had already collected it anyway from you to pay this. So there was never, you know, any real slap on the hand. Slap, you know, it should have been much worse than a slap on the hand. But I just want to mention this because now this is becoming much more public. People are seeing it. You're going to see it in the headlines. And once again, you can send in, email me with your zip code and your water provider company, and I'll send you a water report. I'm a little behind on doing this. If you've emailed in and haven't gotten your report back, it's sitting in my bin. There's only about 38,000 emails in this bin. And so I go through, and there's a lot of junk mail, of course, so I got to wade through all of that stuff. and find your request for water analysis or the wing generator, etc. And I have to wade through this email list to try and find your emails and then go do the little study and respond to it. But the bottom line is that the water in the United States is polluted every place. And so I'll just make this quick. You should have a whole house water filter. And I have them on my webpage, very good price. And when you compare the price of a whole house water filter, couple thousand dollars for that includes the filter and its replacement filters, good grief, and you look at your family's health, here's the biggest issue. You should not be showering in the water that you're getting in from the city or from the ground, coming up through a well of some kind or from the city. You have to get those chemicals out of there because in a shower, they vaporize, you're breathing them in, and they also, that hot water hitting your skin, it goes into your skin and is absorbed in your body. And these are forever chemicals. When they go in there, they stay and they accumulate. It's really a disaster for your body. And if, like I say, the cancer, liver damage, low birth weight, and on and on. I mean, the medical problems are just too many to even enumerate. So my advice is spend a few thousand dollars, get a whole house water filter, and stop. You know, that includes when you're brushing your teeth in the bathroom. That's another place where you take on a lot of chemicals is when you're brushing your teeth. So get fluoride-free toothpaste and use it, and then also have filtered water for your bathroom. And the shower thing, by the way, those little shower filters that you buy at like the, I don't know, wherever you buy them, they're little teeny things that you screw onto the shower head. Those things might work for 10 gallons and only for a couple chemicals, like maybe chlorine. So those are not whole house water filters. They just, they're nice. They probably look nice. They probably make you feel good about that maybe you're doing something. But reality is they're not, you need a real filter to filter out real pollution issues in your water. Okay, so enough of that. But go to my webpage and check those out. And I'm really adamant about this. This year, I'm going to really push on the whole house water filters. It's really important to filter all of the water in your house, especially in the shower. And compare the cost of a whole house water filter with a day in a hospital room for one of your family members. Let me tell you, there's no comparison. Hospital beds today for a cancer patient, upwards of, I don't even know, tens of thousands of dollars per day. So, and plus your health, excuse me, yeah. So switching gears here a little bit, talking about infinity tonight as my main science topic. Now, this is something that stretches the human imagination because the idea of infinity is just really big. So how does the average person on the street get a grasp of this? And as we look out into, say, cosmology, and they talk about the beginning of the universe and the extent of the universe, etc., well, these are concepts. And the reason, now, I think that astronomers in general should just step back and say, hey, you know, every time we build a bigger telescope, a radio telescope, or visible light telescope, or infrared telescope, we see more. We go out and we see the telescope is bigger, more accurate, better resolution. So we see more than what we saw before. So does that mean the universe is all of a sudden growing? And no, what it means is you have simply better observational equipment and you can see you can see things that were not visible to your old equipment. So just looking at this idea of infinity and the human limitation, the human mental limitation, because, you know, as we grow up, just kind of a quirk. When I was a little kid, you know, we'd go up to Grandma's house, and I'd stand down below it. It was kind of up on a hill. And I'd look at Grandma's house, and, man, that was the biggest house I could ever imagine. And then recently, you know, within the last 10 years, I happened to be traveling and got near that town. And so went there and actually went back to Grandma's house and was able to go inside. And it's like, this house is pretty small. You know, so our scale of things changes with time. But just looking at this idea of infinity, it's very possible that the universe is infinite in extent. And our human minds, it's very satisfying for cosmologists and astronomers and astrophysicists to create the concept of a Big Bang, not that the Big Bang is true or not. It satisfies some kind of human need. It's like a song. You know, it comes on the radio. There's a beginning to the song. There's a little middle part. There's some varying verses, and then you come to an end. And then you listen to the next song. And that goes the same way. There's a beginning, goes on for a while. Some songs a little bit longer. There's operas, etc. But most musical scores, certainly the ones that you listen to commonly, all have a beginning and end. And there's somewhat of a resolution to it. Even modern art, when it first came into vogue and it was understood by art critics, there was some type of closure about it. It brought a new dimension to art, but it also gave a closure, like this piece of artwork on a canvas brought you a new dimension in thinking, but there was a limitation. There was a beginning, and an end to it. Or like a movie, you go to, most movies are 2 hours, a little under, a little over. Some of the epic movies are longer, maybe up to 4 hours, but that's, you know, somewhat your limit as far as looking at a movie. But you expect it to have a beginning and an end and a conclusion. You walk away and you go, was there a message or was there just a beautiful story and you're happy, you're crying or whatever. But the human psyche wants a beginning and they want an end. You know, and it's the same for the universe. So when the scientists created this Big Bang concept, and of course they believed they had evidence of this, but when they did, it was something, somewhat of a satisfying thing to the average guy walking down the street, because he had a conclusion, some kind of, he could wrap his mind around something that had a beginning and an end. But like I say, every time you get a bigger telescope, you can see farther. NASA took the Hubble Space Telescope, and there was this black region. It's kind of a fairly big area of outer space where it's just black. Nobody had ever seen anything out there with a telescope. So NASA trained the Hubble Space Telescope on this area for time exposure, extended time, and came back with billions of galaxies. So the dark spot is full of galaxies. And so what if you could get out to that distant area and look all around from there? Would you continue to see out an equally distant region into outer space? And then if you were able to get out to that distance with your telescope and look out again, would you see equally far again? And so these are in a sense the same concept of infinity. So let me just point this out to you. We could live in an infinite universe. We could be just like a little speck here in a universe that's infinite, but our limited human minds could not comprehend this. So it's much more satisfying to have somebody tell you that there was a Big Bang, that it all began, that it's going to expand and it's going to collapse and it's all going to go back to the very same spot and end in this, all this matter going back into this point source. And that's the fate of the universe. And then you can ponder, will it explode again? You know, and, you know, go, all the matter in the universe goes back into this pinhead. But it's satisfying. People accept it, and I don't. I just think it's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. It couldn't possibly be true. in all the data that they cite, the redshift has nothing to do with movement of stars or galaxies or quasars. It has to do with the fusion properties. The non-uniform electric field around a fusion object causes the induced electric dipole redshift, and that's what the redshift is all about. The microwave background radiation has nothing to do with the Big Bang. It's a microwave signature from dust cloud that surrounds our solar system, and you can look around at other stars and see that they're surrounded by a dust cloud, and that's giving off a microwave signature also. So all the data that they're presenting is bogus, has nothing to do with the Big Bang, but it's kind of like a story that people can wrap their brains around. But I can propose right now, and nobody could disprove me. Nobody could disprove me. I'm going to propound that the universe is infinite in all directions. No matter how far you go, you're going to look out into space as far as you can see. You're going to see galaxies, other star systems, quasars, whatever. And if you got out to that point, you would just see again. So how do we deal with the human mind with the concept of infinity? Mathematicians have conquered this idea a long time ago. So let me start by taking a trip to the coast, to the ocean. Take your favorite beach, go there, take a glass of water, or a bucket of water, or a teapot full of water, whatever you want. And count the number of water molecules in that container. It's a pretty big number. More than you could count on your fingers and toes. Even in a lifetime, you couldn't, if you counted them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the water molecules in your container, it would take you more than quite a few lifetimes to count them all individually. And that's just a cup. How about all of the water in all of the Earth's oceans and seas and lakes and rain falling into clouds, all the water on planet Earth, surrounding it, in the ground, everywhere. Now count all the water molecules, and that's a finite number. It's a number that has a limit. There is a limited number of water molecules on planet Earth, and I think everybody could agree with that. There's a limited number. It's a big number, a number that we can't really comprehend, probably. Some people might be able to get an idea in powers of 10 or, you know, in Avogadro's numbers of or whatever. But I think everybody would agree that there's a finite number, a limited number of water molecules on planet Earth. So we could say, okay, that's a Earth unit of waters. If we went to another planet and examined the amount of water on another water planet, we could say, oh, there's so many Earth volumes of water on this planet. And, so that would be some type of measuring stick. But if you looked out into the entire universe, if there's an infinite number of galaxies and water planets, then there would be literally an infinite number of water molecules. But let's look at another concept of infinity. This is kind of an interesting aspect of infinity. And there was a guy named George Cantor who studied infinities. I took a course on his work when I was at the university level doing my double major in physics and mathematics. There was a course I took on infinities. It's a work of George Cantor. He studied the idea of infinities and different sizes of infinities. And here's how it goes. Let's take the counting numbers, the natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and like that. And you count, no matter how far you count out or how big a number you create or write a number down in base 10, you know, with all the digits out as far as you can go, and let's say your entire lifetime, you spend all your lifetime just writing digits out. And that would be a big, big number, but it's still a finite number. And so the idea is, how do you understand the concept of infinity? Or like counting all of the water molecules in the Earth's oceans and sea and atmosphere, all the water molecules related to Earth. And that would be a finite number. But compared to infinity, it's still just a baby number. It's very small. Or when mathematicians by computer discover a prime number, it's a number that's expressed in this, you know, some type of abbreviated format, exponentials, plus one or something. But there again, it's a baby number. It's a little teeny number compared to infinity. And by the way, it really doesn't give you any understanding of prime numbers. It's just a big number. Wow, okay, big deal. It doesn't tell you anything about prior prime numbers. Doesn't tell you anything about future prime numbers. It doesn't give you any information about patterns in prime numbers. It doesn't give you any information at all. It's simply a lone ranger out there in number land. And by the way, it happens to be a very small number. No matter how big you think it is, how impressed you are at how big it is, it's still a baby number. So the idea of infinity, George Cantor tackled this issue. And to understand infinity, you have to understand it in pieces. So if you take all the counting numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and go out as far as you can and just keep going, then you don't ever get to infinity. But if you just continued this process, you would be more moving towards infinity. You would, of course, never get there. But what would happen if between every numbers like 1 and 2, you had 10 numbers in between there, like fractions 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, and actually you'd have 9 numbers in there, 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, up to 1.9. You'd have 9 numbers between 1 and 2. You'd have 9 numbers between 2 and 3, 2.1, 2.2, 2.3. And between 3 and 4, for 2 and 3, 3 and 4, 4 and 5, you would have 9 digits, or not digits, but 9 numbers. And so would you have, if you counted all of those, would you have 9 times infinity? Because you have 9 numbers there for every one in the original counting numbers. You have 9 new numbers. So is there such a thing as 9 times the original infinity? Is 9 times infinity a bigger infinity? Or what if you had, for example, the counting numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and between them you had the rational numbers. In other words, between 1 and 2, you had literally an infinite number of numbers. There's an infinite number of rational numbers. What are rational numbers? They're numbers that are made out of fractions of the counting numbers, like 2/3 and 7/8 and 27/32 and 169/184. Those are rational numbers. It's a quotient dividing one number, integer, by another. Those are the rational numbers. And so at any rate, between every counting number, 1 and 2, 2 and 3, there's an infinite number of rational numbers. So you have an infinity between 1 and 2. You have an infinity between 2 and 3. So if you take all the rational numbers, is that a bigger infinity than the number of integers, the counting number infinity? And the answer is yes, it's another level of infinity. And this is what George Cantor crystallized in his work, in his theoretical work, where nobody up to that point had really thought about this. And then you could take it a step further. Between every two rational numbers, there's an infinite number of real numbers. And so, once again, you have a higher number of infinities. The infinity of real numbers is bigger than the infinity of rational numbers. The infinity of rational numbers is bigger than the infinity of counting numbers. And so you could go on and on. But this is a way that the human mind can manage this concept of infinity. And the other way that mathematicians deal with this issue is known as Peano's postulates, where basically you start with zero and you find what is known in mathematical circles as a successor. So it turns out, and you can create any symbol you want for this, but in modern arithmetic, mathematics, we use the symbol for one and use the word one to represent the number that follows zero. And then the number two follows one. And it turns out that Peano had, he was an Italian mathematician, and he brought the idea of successor sets and something called induction. So the whole concept of induction is that if you take and break down this idea literally of counting numbers, if you have one, if you have starting over at zero, if you have zero, you have one. If you have one, then you have two. Then if you have two, you have three. And then if you have three, then you have four. And you can always create a successor. That, then it gives you an infinite number of elements. You can name them all something. You can organize a numbering system like base 10 numbers. When you get up to nine, then you put a digit and a zero and you start counting all over again. And then when you get to 99, you drop another digit. So you have 100, 100, and you count up to 100 again, and now you go to 200, etc. But it's a counting system. The idea is that those are just symbols. They're just representations of a certain number of, say, apples on a table or soldiers in rows and columns or whatever else you might choose, people in a city. But the idea is that you can understand infinity in little pieces, real little pieces that are the smallest pieces possible, that is unity or one, just a single item. And then you take one and then you have two, then you have three, and you build them up one at a time. And that gives you the concept of infinity. And that's a way that the limited human mind can understand the concept of infinity. Okay, so with that in mind, that little brief introduction, which I hope you can get your brains around and with not too much difficulty, what I'm going to do now is go back to some of my most rudimentary work. This happened many decades ago, in fact, during the time I was at the Cornell University, 1979 to 81, literally 40 years ago at this time frame, as I speak right now, I was promoting these ideas. And literally, nobody can prove me wrong, and I'll start to state them. Number one is, and I'll state these by first stating the standard astronomy, astrophysics, what I call axioms of astronomy or standard beliefs. And then I'll tell you what I believe and why you cannot prove that I'm wrong. Number one is the axiom of astronomy or astrophysics called the Big Bang that says that the universe began in a Big Bang and has been expanding, and everything that's developed, including you walking around this planet, happened by chance and simply out of randomness, in spite of the fact that every water molecule on the far side of the universe is the same as the water molecules we have here, and we know that because you can take measurements. Nobody's ever found a water molecule that was different. They have very specific properties, and those are uniform throughout the entire universe. So that tells me that there's some order here and that there's a design, there's a grand design. But instead of the Big Bang, where the universe began at one particular point in this alleged explosion, I'm going to just tell you that, no, the infinite universe exists. It's infinite in scope. It's infinite in all directions. it's consistent in all directions. In other words, the physical properties of galaxies and stars and planets, et cetera, and water and molecules is the same any place in this infinite universe. And the reason we really can't, this hasn't emerged, is because the human mind really needs to be satisfied with something smaller, with something that's finite, that it has a beginning, it has an end, and that's what the human psyche is looking for. It's thirsty, it's hungry for that concept of beginning and end and closure. And when we have court cases, or even if somebody dies, you use the word closure because you want the at least an idea that you can put in your brain and sit on, and even though you don't want to, accept it and move on. It's called closure. And so the human psyche is always looking for closure. But what I'm telling you is, in the universe, the universe is infinite. And it's just like the number line. If you keep counting and counting and counting, or in the universe, you keep going out, you know, as far as you can see, and then you get to that spot and you take your telescope with you and you look out as far as you can see again, and you still see more of the same, and then you go out as far as you can see there. Thought that was the edge of the universe, and lo and behold, you can see as far as you could see before, but still additional distance out into this infinite universe. And after a while, you go, doggone, no matter where we go, no matter what direction we go in, there's more out there. And so this is a concept that human beings would have a hard time with, just from a psychological point of view. So that's my axiom. That's McCanny axiom number one, that the universe is infinite in scope, in dimension. And it's consistent. There's a design to this. There's a design to this. Okay. Number two, that the solar system, axiom of astronomy number two, which is false, is that the solar system began at 4.5 billion years ago. Once again, this idea that it had a beginning. And there was a rough time, and you can put a number on that, even though nobody can really understand these terms. It's 4.5 billion years. It's more than you or I could really grasp. But it also provides astronomers with a handy little tool that it's over such a long period of time that nobody can question whether they're right or wrong about this cosmological evolution thing, or biological evolution. And all of a sudden, you're walking around on a planet. Hey, it sounds pretty convincing. The only problem is there's not a shred of evidence to suggest that that is what happened. It's a good story. It looks good in a textbook. Lots of nice pictures drawn. Gives you the concept of a beginning and potentially an end, supposedly when the star dies some days. But there again, there's no reason to believe that this solar system had an actual beginning and end. I actually have a paper that's published, peer-reviewed physics journal, astrophysics journal, in one of my papers when I was at the mathematics department at Cornell, and it's on galactic evolution. And I literally state in there that the star systems do have a beginning. It's when they come out of the galactic nuclear region in a fluid flow problem. It's a very hot, gaseous fluid flow with infalling matter pushing the two arms out the opposite sides of the galaxy. It's a simple fluid flow problem. That's what it is. It's hydrodynamic fluid flow. Okay, so anyway, be that as it may, star systems do have their beginning. So our sun and Jupiter were the original star systems, and everything else came later. All the other planets, all the moons, all the asteroids, everything else came later as captured items. And you need two gravitational objects to create the phenomenon of capture. So anyway, that's my axiom number two, that the solar system dating and the Earth dating is completely bogus, that this 4.5 billion year dating scheme has no place in reality at all. And by the way, the reason that came about is people picked up rocks on the surface of the Earth and allegedly on the moon and did some dating methods and came up with 4.5 billion years. How that is done is very questionable, but the whole point is the rocks on the surface of the Earth have absolutely nothing to do with the age of the Earth. Nobody's gone down more than a couple miles into the Earth, so nobody has any sample or data or information on the deeper in the Earth, which is all molten anyway. How are you going to make heads or tails out of that? So the Earth could be much younger, or it could be much, much older than 4.5 billion years. And by the way, you'd say, well, how does the sun keep burning for that long period of time? And the answer is very simple. It keeps being replenished with hydrogen. And something very simple here, by the way, is that with this 4.5 billion year lifetime of the solar system, there's not enough hydrogen, and there would not have been enough hydrogen in the sun's to burn for that period of time and provide the light and the solar wind that occurs all the time. And so the end result is that the sun has to be replenished with hydrogen to do what it's doing today. So given that fact that the sun is being constantly being replenished with hydrogen, the idea that there's a date when the sun began is maybe it began on at a certain time period, but there's no way of actually associating that with the planets that are going around it. Those all were captured at different dates, at different times. And so number two, the solar system dating is completely bogus in standard astronomy. And literally, you cannot date the planets. You cannot put a date on them because we don't have any physical evidence for the dating process. There's no measurement technique. There's no dating measurement yardstick that you can use to date the planets. Okay, number three is that the universe is electrical in nature, and that's just patently true. But then if you understand that planets are built from the capture of comets being the discharge of the solar capacitor. Remember that the European Space Agency landed on the surface of a comet, and there was no ice or water or snow, and there's nothing coming off the nucleus. Now, what they found were organic molecules, or organic, it was like sand made up of organic chemistry. That's what they found. There was nothing ice ball about it. There was nothing snowball about it. So I'm absolutely correct about the idea that comets are the discharge of the solar capacitor. And the big ones, not every comet becomes a planet, so don't misquote me on that. But the big ones can, if all the right conditions are there, and we've only had 9 big ones in the history of the solar system, and say maybe another 30, 40 moons of various planets, of Saturn, of Jupiter, our own moon. And NASA itself said that 27 of the Saturn moons could not possibly have been originals of the solar system. So why not all of them? They were all captured, literally, is the answer. And so there again, from that point of view, you cannot put a date on the planets or the planetary system, because they all occurred, they all began, they all formed at different time periods in the history of the solar system. So that brings us up to the final count of the incorrect axioms of astronomy, of standard astronomy, and the correct axioms that we should be using. So once again, just a little review. Axiom number one of standard astronomy, the Big Bang, couldn't possibly be true. We live in a universe that, as far as we can see, it's infinite. And nobody can disprove me if I said that we live in a literally infinite universe. There's literally nobody that could disprove this. And the astronomers somewhat bank on a similar issue when they talk about the Big Bang. There was nobody around. There was no, you know, it's all circumstantial evidence at best. You couldn't use this to convict a criminal in a court of law, what they're trying to pawn off on the public. So the universe is literally infinite, and nobody can challenge me and prove that I'm wrong. They literally can't, because you can never get to the edge of the universe to understand that there is some kind of boundary. Okay, number two, the same issue goes with the planets. There's no date where it began, the same with the universe. There's no beginning or end date. And the human mind just can't absorb this any more than it can absorb infinite number of counting numbers, something very simple in the world of infinities. And so then the other issue is that comets are not dirty snowballs. That's proven. There's no question about that anymore. I'm absolutely right about that, that comets are the discharge of the solar capacitor. And then the last one is that space is electrical, very electrical. And it occurs only in subtle ways. It's not like planets are flying around based on electric fields. You have to understand all the subtleties of this. It turns out that the only real motion type of effects from electricity are with the very smallest objects. Anything bigger than a golf ball, the surface to mass ratio of the object and then the charge to mass ratio of the object is very high for small objects and very low for big objects. So big objects don't have electrical effects. They have electrical effects on smaller objects that are visible, patently visible. You see it all over the place. But big objects, in terms of changing their motion or affecting their motion, are not affected by electricity. It's primarily a gravitational universe. Okay, so anyway, that's a stretch of the mind looking into the infinity of the universe, something that literally could not be disproven. Because as NASA showed, when they looked out into that dark spot, the dark spot where nobody had ever seen anything before, they saw billions of galaxies, tremendous amount of activity going on out there. And so it just turns out that no matter where you look, no matter how far you look, you're going to see more. Just a couple of final notes here. Remember, go to my webpage, a lot of information there. The wing generation, I have the wing generator, I have the new subpage for the shipping containers. Go and check that out. All the information that I used to email to people regarding shipping containers and shipping container buildings, this is all factory built. First time that this would be used would be by yourself when you purchase these. These are not one-time or used containers. These are brand new factory built containers delivered to your location on my webpage. And then the water filters, the whole house water filters, and I'm really going to insist that you take a serious look at these. These are unbelievably good pricing, something that you won't find anyplace else with the quality of the removal of toxins, etc., for the entire house. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. The webpage, jmccsci.com. We are at the crossroads. Good night.